Good morning, universe, and welcome to another day, redeemed from death and looking forward to life because of what our Lord Jesus Christ has done for us. You're listening to Sharper Iron, waking you up every morning with the law and gospel of the living God, drawn straight from the text of Holy Scripture for you, all a part of your morning drive for the soul here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, administrative pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Rockford, Illinois. And on this Tuesday, the 19th of March, we are looking at it's about that point in the book of Genesis. You're like, I'm going to read the Bible in a year. And like, you start reading, it's like, oh, it's story. It's good. I like it. I like, okay, fall. That's sad. Oh, Cain and Abel. Well, that's crazy. And it's about this point that you start wondering, can I skip a chapter? Because it's a genealogy. It's just a list of names and years, and they're weird years and what's going on. But the thing is about these genealogies is they have a ton of historical information and more depth and detail than you maybe catch on your first cursory reading. So looking today at Genesis chapter 4, just the end of the chapter, verse 25 and 26, and then all of Genesis chapter 5. To help us out making our way through the timeline, asking about these dates, years, and names, we have with us Pastor Dustin Beck. He is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Corpus Christi, Texas. Pastor Beck, welcome back to Sharper Iron. In terms of context, I don't know how much we want to retell the story up to this point, but I don't know any pastor anywhere that doesn't like to talk a little bit about Genesis chapter 3 and its impact on everything that we believe about who we are. So I want to give you that shot to kind of bring us kind of back up to speed from your own point of preaching.
I appreciate that. Yeah. So two things. First of all, I always like to always start from, you said, the context. And the context that we're talking about here is, when I hear the word context, I don't just mean the chapter or two before and the chapter or two after. What I'm talking about is, where is this text actually being spoken? Where is this text actually being proclaimed? Where is it being handed down? And the truth is that this is a book of Moses, right? And so this is the Israelites wandering the wilderness. And while they are wandering the wilderness, Moses is telling them, he is narrating to them, this is your story. This is where you came from. This is how you came to be wandering here through the wilderness, going to Mount Sinai, heading towards the promised land. Now we've got 40 years to, kind of wander. I almost said 40 years to kill, but that sounded a little bit too much like letting that generation just pass away. So we'll refrain from that. Nevertheless, 40 years here, and this is the context in which Moses is proclaiming to them, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He talks about the perfection, the beauty of it all. And then he talks about the cataclysmic event, and that's the second thing that I wanted to point out. As you said, you almost have to go back to Genesis 3. I feel like that's probably one of the texts that most Lutheran pastors, if there's a text that we preach on from the Old Testament more than anything else, it's probably Genesis 3, because it is such a cataclysmic event. It is all-encompassing. The entire universe, it gets a shelf life. It gets an expiration date. It's no longer that very good that God put upon it, that label that he put upon it. That's not to say that there isn't some good here, there, and yonder, but nevertheless, there is a brokenness to everything in existence ever since Adam and Eve's first sin of disobedience, their first sin of a broken faith and an ordering not towards God but towards themselves instead. And then what we have between Adam and Eve's fall and the calling of Abram is we find that the fall into sin, not only was it a cataclysmic event, but then beyond that, it was the first in many kind of, you ever have that happen where you fall and you try to catch yourself and then you stumble, you maybe tumble down the hill a little bit and then you fall. Right, and so that's kind of the narrative that progresses from Genesis 3 all the way through the flood, and right up until the calling of Abram, is we have this continual falling deeper into sin, and that's what we see a little bit in yesterday's text about the generations of Cain, and then today's text we're going to have the generations of Seth, of the faithful the faithful ones, the righteous ones, the generations of the ones who carry the promise of the Messiah. And so I get to actually give you a little bit of good news, because even in a bad news world, there's always the good news of the gospel.
Yeah, amen to that. And you have the good news up until, you don't get to do the bad news, I think it's tomorrow, when then this Generations of Seth decides, hey, you know, those girls from the Generations of Cain, they're kind of pretty. And
right.
The next thing you know, we're really in trouble. And I wonder a little bit, you threw at me a lot of the meanings of the names, which I really appreciate in the genealogy. And I wonder if in these names we can kind of perceive the shift that takes place. But we'll maybe pick that up when we get there. So what are your thoughts about the fact that Moses decides to teach them about Cain's generations before Seth's generations? Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, that wouldn't you want to like have the good guys first, and then oh yeah, there's these other guys over here? But he goes straight at Cain to Lamech.
Well, I think that Cain to Lamech is just a continuation of the Cain and Abel story, right? And so that ties it up with a nice bow of saying, here's what happened with the Cain and Abel incident. Right. And then, well, here's the end of that story is Cain went off and, you know, made his city. You know, I loved that yesterday, that he almost sort of refused to be that wandering sojourner that God mm-hmm. had named him to be. And instead he said, I'm going to go build a city. You know, it's that same deal where, you know, his own mouth has convicted himself. You know, he stands guilty because he's, you know, he went against God. He continued to be that Lord for himself, you know, and I think that's something that we could do some talking about. But the name Cain, right? When Eve, when she says, "I have gotten a man," there's almost this kind of there's this seizing, like, "Look what I did," kind of a deal. And isn't that kind of the story of Cain? I mean, throughout Genesis 4 and beyond is the story of the guy who, by the work of his hands and the sweat of his brow, he has brought a sacrifice that God is going to be pleased with, instead of having a substitutionary atonement type of sacrifice like Abel did, where he says, look, there's this living thing that I've brought, and it's going to die in my place because of sin, right? So Cain constantly has this this idea of building himself up. And I think that's the most practical reason for why the generations of Cain are labeled there, is that that's the end of that story. That's the end of that line. That's Cain doing what Cain's going to do, right? Now we can move on to the story of God saving everybody.
I wonder if it's also not an emphasis that the Church of God is always sort of hidden underneath the ugly. So that what we see is the children of Cain making instruments and weapons and civilization, right? And then, oh, but don't forget, here's this other group that's also here. And they are, at least so far as we see it initially, clinging to the promises of God. So looking again at Genesis chapter...
Luther
go ahead.
Point quite a bit. You know, just in the Luther's commentary, which, by the way, if any of the listeners haven't taken a look at Luther's works... he spends out of the I've got 55, 56 of the Luther's works in the American edition, and out of those he spends the first 8 volumes on Genesis alone. Like, he is this
it's
Old
crazy.
Testament guy, and it's so much fun to read because some of it is just sanctified common sense and just sanctified opinions. You know, he just says, I think that it's kind of like this. And it's so fun to read because it's just like Luther using his imagination, you know, and he's, I mean, he's, I don't think he's saying this is inspired, but he's saying, you know, it's probably like this. And he says some of what you just said about how, you know, the sons of Cain warring against the sons of Adam, the sons of Seth, right? And there's this kind of this idea, and of course Luther kind of conflates it to be the papacy, and at some point the Jewish rabbis, you know, and everything like that. But he says that's the same way that it is today. How they're out to get us, the faithful branch. They're out to get us. They're, you know, and I think there's something to that as well. You have the building up of Cain's line, but never forget the building up of the line of Christ either.
Yes, I laugh at. I love Luther, But the papacy was under every rock a shadow. He's right, though. You know, when you take what they say about what the Pope says about himself, if you take it seriously, it is a diabolical teaching. Now, most Catholics don't take it that seriously, which kind of is part of the issue. But I'm all for the sanctified imagination, provided we can keep it just that. Maybe it was like this. Maybe it was like that. That helps me picture it. Fine. That's good. That doesn't make it a dogmatic truth, right? The dogmatic truth is a different thing. And we have those too. And we shouldn't fail to recognize those things. But to try to imagine, you know, what these civilizations look like and all that, or to ask why is this laid out this way, there's a place for a gamble on that, provided it stays within the dogmatic truth. And that's the beauty of confessions, right? Is that it keeps us within the dogmatic truth. So moving to verse 25 of Chapter 4, Book of Genesis, really should be the start of the next chapter, right? Because it is the next chapter here as we move out of the Cain story, beginning with Cain and Abel and then his generations, to now the story of Seth and his generations. It says, and Adam, and maybe you should say it's the story of Adam and his generations. In a sense, Cain is removed. And Adam knew his wife again. That's woman, by the way, her first name. Woman Eve was her full name, I think. And Adam knew woman again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. So here you have it. You don't always get this in the Old Testament, but we've talked quite a bit about how the names have meanings. Or really, it's not that the names have meanings. The names are words, not names. And those words have meanings. And sometimes you'll see them explaining why they're calling their kid this word. And so here she says, this guy's going to be named Seth. Now, I actually don't have it memorized. I know you've got it in your notes, but I don't know where. So it has to do with being appointed, right? Is that, I'm just guessing from looking at God as appointed.
Yeah, he has placed or he has appointed, he has put. It's just a Hebrew verb, sheath, right? Which means to put or to place. I mean, I remember that from my vocabulary in Hebrew, which, you know, it just blows your mind whenever you, because you're so used to reading these proper names. But then whenever you look at it a little bit more closely, those aren't just proper names. There's no such thing as just proper names in Hebrew. These names are basic, you know, root words that are applied to people. Seth is the one who is appointed. Seth is the one who is placed there. And Luther has, again, this kind of sanctified imagination where he goes off a little bit and he says that, in his opinion, he doesn't think that they had any kids between, after the Cain and Abel incident, right? Cain murders Abel. Luther thinks, man, they stopped having kids after that. Obviously, they had kids at some point, because, you know, Cain had a wife, et cetera, so on and so forth. But Luther has this idea of, like, you know, there was a moment in time where they were so afraid of, you know, and so despondent over the loss of Abel that they just, life kind of stopped for them. And then Luther, again, I love this, like you, I love this kind of imaginative Luther. He says, you know, that they were likely warned, you know, admonished by an angel. Remember what God said, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it. And then
so
Adam knew his wife again, right? And that's where the story picks back up. There's this weird little thing in Hebrew, when you have a verb, it actually takes on the gender of the person performing the verb. And so the one who names Seth is Eve. She called his name Seth, and she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. And this is Luther, obviously a very big fan of the Virgin Mary, Virgin Mary and of Eve, the mother of us all. And so Luther is going to go out and he's going to say, you know, that this is Eve speaking the word of God. This is Eve saying, this is the one. Right? This is the one. This is the seed to replace Abel because Cain, his brother, killed him. So I really enjoyed that little detail. I'd never caught that before in my entire life, that here Eve is the one that gives the name.
Right. That is interesting. I like the idea of the appointment being connected to the covenant promise. There's a clear recognition in the name itself, whether it was fully comprehended by Eve, but I would want to say probably is.
Yeah.
There's a clear recognition that Cain is not the Lord, nor right. the Messiah, and that Abel, her other son, has been taken from her by him. And so now this is the man who shall receive what I was taught to call, you know, I haven't heard this language from Lutheran pastors a lot, but I was taught this in a Lutheran day school, the covenant promise. Right. Mm. So yeah. the extending forward of the promise of the seed that it's going to come through you. Right. And it doesn't happen to everybody. It certainly doesn't happen to all of Seth's sons. But it does happen right. Through two particular people, Seth being one of them, Noah being one of them, Abraham being one of them, David being one of them, right? The covenant promise line. Yeah. And you think of Jacob over Judah, right? When he brings the sons in and he passes it on, it's going to be from you, the lion. So yeah. That idea is in the name appointed one, right? Or the one from which it will come.
Yeah. I should also mention that Seth is he's in contrast to Cain. So remember what we said right at the opening, you know, that Cain is the one, you know, I have gotten a man. Like that's what Cain means, is acquired or gotten.
Mm.
And there's this idea of, and that goes into Cain's entire persona. Cain is the one who's going to reach out, stretch out, and grab it. And instead, Seth is the one who has been placed here, or who has been, I don't know if it's too much of a stretch to say that replaced. Right, because he's the replacement of Abel. He's the one that God has placed, that God has appointed right here to be the bearer of that that gospel message. And remember again, the ESV kind of does us a disservice here. Well, I mean, I guess it's consistent, but it says God has appointed for me another, and the word they have there is offspring instead of Abel. But the offspring word there is the word seed.
Yeah.
Right, the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. That's seed right there. Instead of Abel, notice she passes completely over Cain. Right, appointed for me another offspring, another seed instead of Abel, because Cain killed him. So, it's good stuff.
Keeping connection with that promise. So there is this appointed one who is now given this one who is to be seen as the bearer of the promise. But now we're recognizing that the promise has to come from God, and we're not going to do it. So you definitely have law, gospel, you have works versus grace there, right? Versus grace. And then it says, to Seth also a son was born. He called his name Enosh, and so we got a name issue there to deal with. But you also have this strange line, right? At that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. This is at the time of Enosh. Well, what does that mean? I mean, we know that up to this point in the book, then, generally when God is mentioned, he is called Elohim, right? The gods, if we're going to take it literally, but as we've talked about, probably a reference to the Trinity. It's the old way of saying Trinity. We translate it as singular God. The name Yahweh has been used by Moses up to this point, but now here this word Lord, Yahweh, proper name of God, meaning the one who is, I think, this is the first time that historically it's being used according to Moses. Moses is saying now at this time they start calling him by the name he gave me and he gave Abraham to use. That's interesting, right?
Yeah.
Does that mean that there's more revelation taking place at this point? I mean, I have to say yes. I don't know how, but how else are they getting this hidden eternal name of God given to them? What do you think?
Right. So obviously, we have to remember the fact that Adam is alive at this point, right? One of the things that I sent to you, I attached is a chart that kind of says, you know, and we'll get into some of this later, but it basically talks about how old Adam is whenever he has Seth, how old Seth is when he has Enosh. Kind of, you know, we work through this, and so Adam's alive at this point. This isn't like, you know, Josiah's reform where they rediscover the word of God or something like that. But instead, this is Enosh, whose name just means man or mankind, kind of a interesting, just kind of generic name, which, by the way, I have to get this in every time I get a chance, that the name Adam comes from Adamah, which means dust, and so that's where my name is found in the Bible, is if you actually translate Adam, you get dusty. So there, that's me.
There you
Anyways.
Go. That's fun. I like to call him Dirt, though. Dirt's a better translation. So I'll just call you Dirt from now on. My name is Dirt.
I can work
My name
that.
Is Mud.
Call me Dust. Yes. Nevertheless, So they begin to call upon the name of the Lord. Luther does something that I think is incredible with this. He says it's not that they didn't call upon the Lord before this, because Adam is the one who walks in communion with God. Abel is offering sacrifices to God. I mean, there is this idea that God is here with his people, but now something new or different is happening. And so Luther says, he kind of gives one opinion where he says that, you know, this is when they put together a formality, like a formal way of worshiping God, which, I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, you've got to codify something. The tradition has to begin at some point. But what I liked even more was Luther makes the distinction between calling upon the Lord and calling upon the name of the Lord. Okay? And the distinction that Luther makes is he says that when it says the name of the Lord, what he's talking about is the divine logos. What he's talking about is this is when they began to worship Jesus. Hmm. And that blew my mind. This is sanctified imagination Luther here. I'm inclined to be with him on this and say that, you know, like we talk about in the Old Testament, anytime that the Malach, Yahweh, the angel of the Lord, you know, all caps Lord, the angel of Yahweh, we say that's the pre-incarnate Jesus. A lot of us do, right? I'm completely comfortable with saying that calling upon the name of the Lord means, you know, invoking the name of God, which, you know, Jesus is the image of the invisible God. He is the one by whom God makes himself known to us. And so I think that there is some sort of revelation going on in this verse. But I think that Luther's right on when he says that the Christian can read this and they can say that this is when, the pre-incarnate Christ shows up in that sort of a way, and that worship is rightly celebrated, which I don't know how that works on you, but I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm wrestling with it a little bit, mainly because of the, kind of wondering, maybe it's exactly what I said, and I said it in a poor way. So the way I envision this is that they're having right and proper worship of God through whatever God established, and I don't think there's any accident that. And I don't think you can be dogmatic about this, but I almost am. I don't think there's any accident that Abel is bringing blood atonement sacrifice, and that Abel or that Cain bringing the work of his hands is not sufficient. And that although grain offerings are certainly allowable or prescribed in the Old Testament, they are not prescribed for atonement. They're usually thank offerings, right? As opposed to some sort of replacement or substitutionary thing. So that worship's going on and they're calling upon God, but then are they calling upon Yahweh by name? And that's where then, so this name of Yahweh shows up. And how did that happen? What revelation makes this come to be? You could also be really, really vanilla with this too, I think. I can imagine in the other direction. This is just saying that the church began to grow. Right. So up to this point, if we go away from we've had a bunch of kids by this point, that we just have Cain, Abel, their wives, and that's it. And then we have Enosh show up and he starts having kids because Seth show up and then he starts having kids. Now we've got church. Now we've got a small community beginning to develop. And so, this assembly of the name of the Lord is there. This demonstrates, it's a really good point, I think, that we can't be too, whatever our favorite understanding is, we have to kind of like dance with it a little bit.
Yeah.
And then let it be that the text is unclear. And so if we're going to try to explain it, we want to use clear texts from other passages to explain it and then recognize how and when that becomes untenable as kind of a permanent position. You mentioned the angel of the Lord. See, I think that's a different thing altogether. I don't think you can honestly, you can be a Christian and not think the angel of the Lord is Jesus, but then once you've been shown the texts of the Bible that make it really, really clear that it is, you really can't anymore. You're not allowed to. I put that at the level of false teaching because it's just so clear when you line all the pieces up. It gives you a little more backwork to do it than one paragraph. So I'm with you, and yet I'm also kind of like, yeah, I'm not sure. But that's exactly where this kind of stuff puts us. And speaking of that, I suppose, that puts us at our time for a break. Looking at Genesis chapter 4, verses 25 through chapter 5, we barely have touched on these names. And I want to get to this timeline with Pastor Dustin Beck. Sharper iron, stick around.
Hi, this is Bart Day, President and CEO of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Every day, our Lutheran schools reach out to children and families with the love of Jesus. Our schools are a rich and vital component of the church, and in fact, they are the single greatest ministry we share that can shape the future growth and expansion of the Synod. And so whether it's a customized loan to fit your school's particular needs, or help living out your ministry's God-given purpose, we want to help your ministry flourish and grow. So visit us at lcef.org to learn more.
When Jesus meets the woman at the well in John chapter 4, he promises her living water. What is that living water? Tuesday on Issues Etc., we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on Jesus and the Samaritan woman. We'll also continue our series responding to Calvinist proof texts with Pastor Jordan Cooper.
Issues Etc., live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
Hello, this is Dale Meyer, and I'm the host of Concordia Seminary's program, Word and Work, an Intersection. It airs weekly on Thursday afternoons at 2 o'clock Central Time, right here on KFUO. Together, we'll discover how the Word of God applies to daily life as we go about our various vocation. Be sure to tune in each week for an interesting discussion taking place at the intersection of Word and Work.
For the next Law and Gospel, which is a Rumination Tuesday, with the help of Pastor Mark Smith, we will be taking a look at the hymn, May God Bestow on Us His Grace. But is grace a power source from God, or is it His attitude toward us?
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday mornings beginning at 9:30 on KFUO.
Man began to spread out upon the world following the killing of one of the first men by his brother, and two civilizations arise, the sons of men and the sons of God. We're looking at those generations now on Sharper Iron. Yesterday, the sons of Cain. Today, the generations of Seth, the one appointed as a replacement for the lost son Abel, but also as the one to bear the promise that from him, from man, would come a seed born of woman to crush death under his heel. And of course, that is Jesus Christ, our Lord. Sharp Iron, looking at Genesis chapter 4, verses 24 through the end of chapter 5 with Pastor Dustin Beck. Pastor Beck is pastor. Oh, I lost my calendar. Pastor Beck is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Corpus Christi, Texas. I should have that memorized by now. And he has been helping us out again with this, seeing the movement now into, a generation of people that at least initially are believing in the promises. The question is, what happens next? Now, at the risk of being boring, I don't know how to do this. I don't know if I should just read this all the way through or just do it one. We're going to do it one bit at a time. But I want to get to the timeline too, and that's so important. And I don't want to lose time on the end. Chapter 5 begins like this. This is the book of the generations of Adam. So now it is pointing Seth to being the lineage of Adam. When God created man, he made him in his likeness of God, in the likeness of God, excuse me. Male and female, he created them. Notice the plurality in the image of God. We talked about that quite a bit. And he blessed them and named them man, plural man, singular, when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, and this is maybe where Luther gets his idea that they waited a while for Seth, because 130 years is a long time. He fathered a son in his own likeness after his image. He named him Seth. The days of Adam after he fathered Seth were 800 years. And he had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. Now, there is a couple things here that we could dig right into. First off is the pattern that's going to show up. This is the way that every one of these individuals is going to be talked about. So there's something important about the way that the Hebrews are remembering these individuals. The length of their life is certainly important, but also stunning to the level of, if you want, along with talking snakes, this would be kind of where the atheist likes to go and say, see, stupid Christian, and you just can't believe this. It's impossible. So you got that issue here. You got the death. So the, and he died is going to be the resounding refrain of this, as opposed to, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good in Genesis chapter 1. And you got that question of the image of God that I brought up there at the start, that Seth is in the image of man, Adam, and Adam is in the image of God, male and female. So any of those, Pastor Beck, where do you want to hit first?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. to like give me nine different things to talk about.
That's right.
One of the things that I read a couple of different commentaries about this, and one of the things that kind of struck me just as interesting that I had not thought of before is the fact that, you know, let's take for instance, let's look at, verse 6 dealing with 6 and 7 dealing with Seth. So this is kind of like you said, the typical way that it goes. When Seth had lived 105 years, he fathered Enosh. Seth lived after he fathered Enosh 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. What it does not say is that he became a father at 105 years old. It simply says he fathered Enosh. Okay, and so this is, I mean, this is very, very in keeping with our understanding of the Old Testament, right? As you said, Judah is not the firstborn, right? He's number four in line. It is not always the firstborn that receives the namesake, that receives the recognition, that receives the what we're concerned with right here is the messianic promise. Right. And so it would be, in my estimation, it would be a little ridiculous to think that some of these guys, these gentlemen lived like 160 years before they had kids or, you know, things like that. And that's why I know that one of the questions that we're going to get to in a little bit, I'm kind of putting the cart before the horse here, but I feel like this is the elephant in the room, is that anybody who's ever done any kind of serious biblical study, when they get to stuff like this, and I know you said at the beginning of the program, this is one of those chapters that you would skip over because it's repetitive and boring and everything like that. But if you really get into serious study of Scripture, this is one of those times when I did this when I was in high school. I kind of plotted out, okay, so he is born here, he is born here, and how does all that shake up? How does all that line up? And so you can kind of construct a little bit of a timeline there of when so-and-so was born and when so-and-so fathered so-and-so and everything else. And that's how you start getting at, you know, people's different timelines of when creation happened, okay? And My caution about that is to say that, you know, again, why is Moses telling Israel these things? And the answer is not so that they can say, you know, while they're wandering in the wilderness, well, Moses, we sat down with a tablet and we chiseled out a few numbers and we figured out just how long ago creation was. That's not the thrust of what's going on when they're wandering in the wilderness. That's not what Moses is proclaiming to them. That's not the point of it at all. The point of it is that God is working through history in spite of this death stuff that we keep carrying along with us. God is working through history, and that there is, I love this image of kind of this crimson thread, right, that is the blood of Christ, right? But it's the seed of the woman that goes all the way back to Seth, and it runs through. This family lineage, as the promise is passed down, and it's, you know, you are the one through whom this promise will be fulfilled. You are the one through whom this promise will be fulfilled, and that is the way that this kind of works itself out to get all the way to Noah, and then to Abraham, to David, to Moses, to David, etc. So that's the first thing that just jumped off the page to me.
I've always wondered about that kind of quietly in the back of my head and maybe never let myself ask the question. Like, why does Enosh, forgive me, I'm a man, so I'm going to say it the way a man's mind works. Why does Enosh wait 105 years to have sex? That is madness. Yeah. What is he doing, right? He should be married, of course, right? But what? And then 70 years, 160, Jared lived 162 years as a single guy? It's nuts. So maybe that's not what happened. Just the idea there that these aren't the firstborn. That these are just, of the many sons and daughters that they have, these are the ones through whom Jesus comes.
Yeah.
That is so wonderful as a thought to me, and just relieves pressure. It doesn't relieve the pressure of how they live so long, right? So there's that one still.
That's
so I'm going to throw my initial questions back at you. How'd they live so long, the refrain of death, and then the image of God in Seth.
Okay, and, let's start with the image of God in Seth. I think that is essentially well, first of all, I think that's good news for us, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
When Adam is, when Noah is telling the Israelites this while they're wandering through the wilderness, he's going to start back at the beginning for the third time, right? We've got Genesis 1, where God creates the heavens and the earth. We've got Genesis 2, where we kind of have, here's another way of telling the creation account. This time, instead of starting from, in the beginning was the Word, everything was formless and void. I know that's John. But now this time, we're going to start from the God that gets down on his hands and knees and forms man out of the dust of the ground and breathes the spirit of life into him. Right, so there's kind of a transcendent and then an immanent version of God, a God of the universe, and then a God of you and me. Right, so that's Genesis 1, that's Genesis 2. And now we have God who is propagating, God who is allowing mankind to procreate, that mankind could take part in the forwarding of creation through being fruitful and multiplying. And he makes the point of saying that Adam was created in the likeness of God, and male and female he created them. But then he's going to go and he's going to say this, that Adam's son, Seth, was in his own likeness, and he was after his own image, right? And so this is a proclamation that in some way we still resemble God. And that's not going to go away. In some way, we still resemble God. And I think that this, you could take this in any number of directions. The fact that we have a consciousness, the fact that we are able to reason, and we are rational beings, right? Unlike the animals. The fact that have religion. The fact that we do worship. Everyone has a God. Right, the fact that that we do fear death, the fact that we choose life, that we want to be people of the truth, at least most of us do, because truth is reality, right? And then the other side of that is that we are built to be in community with each other. We're right now at Trinity, we're going through Life Together by Bonhoeffer during our Lenten midweeks. And that's one of the things that we keep going back to, is that God created us to be in community with each other. The very first thing that's not good in the Bible is it is not good for the man to be alone. Right? And so he has created us for community. He has created us to be together. And the very fact that we are together and that we have families and that we have gifts like marriage is a sign, it shows us that God has created us to be in community. Right? And I would also echo this and just say that I don't think it's too far of a stretch to say that God, not that he's incomplete without the community, but that God desires community with us too. That's why one of the reasons why I believe he creates mankind is that he can have people to show forth his love towards them, and that they can return thanks to him, that there can be someone for him to love and someone to love him back. I think that's beautiful, and I don't think that in any way denigrates God or puts him into a place where, God is incomplete before creation or something like that.
No. But the one thing we know about the imminent eternal God, the one we can't get to, right, the one we can't see or understand, the Trinity in persons with each other, is that they're in eternal conversation with each other. So to be more than one person in conversation, it's not just that you can talk and that's the image of God, but it's that you are in conversation with others. That is something special and unique to mankind that was not lost in the fall. It's texts like this that make me cringe a little when people say that the image of God was lost in the fall. I say, well, kinda. It was shattered. Yeah. It was broken. It was made subject to the curse. It was dirtied. Yes, all that.
Well, it's like a cracked mirror. You can still see a little bit of it, right? But it's clearly broken. It's clearly
I like cracked mirrors because I can see more of me. I see me there like 50 times. It's lots of me. So, all right. So the refrain of death we got left, and then we have the question of their ages, and then we got to get to the timeline. We're gonna run out of time.
Yeah,
keep going.
There we go. So the refrain of death. Yeah, this is it is, and I like that you kind of bookended that with, and it was good, and it was good, and now we have, and he died, and he died.
Right.
That is the story of mankind since the fall, right? That was the promise that God gave to Adam. He said, in the day that you eat of this, you will die. And so it doesn't come to us as a surprise, but I do think that it is a powerful motif to kind of have here over and over and over again. What does Paul say? Death reigned.
right.
Over and over again, we see that, these people that have the promise of God, even these people that are in the line of Christ, even that death has the final say over them at this point. Okay, and then there's the big elephant in the room. Methuselah lived to be 969 years old. My goodness, what do we do with that? Well, there's a couple of ways of talking about this. The one that I prefer, again, a little bit of sanctified imagination here, is so these people were in a lot closer proximity to the tree of life than we are. Right? And there's actually a verse that's coming up in a few chapters in which God limits the age of man. Right? No more Methuselah's after the flood. After the flood, God says, I can't remember, is this where he limits it to 80 or is this where he limits it to 120?
I think it's when, it's 120. Yeah. The flood's going to do that. Takes it down to 120.
Right. And then it's in the Psalms that he talks about are the years of his life are 80 or, 70
by strength.
Or 80 by strength. Right. So here we do have, I believe that this is a proximity to the tree of life. They've imbibed of the tree of life. Adam has, and that, that kind of stands along. I think that God's original plan was for us to live forever. I mean, that's why there's a tree of life in the Garden of Eden. And then, as time goes along, as mankind goes more and more wicked, right? 900 years is a long time. It's a lot of time to forget about God. It's a lot of time to forsake him. Right,
and that's good.
That's kind of, at least again in my theological kind of sanctified imagination, I think that's where it's going. As far as we're not going to have any more of these Methuselah types. Instead, for your own good, we're going to limit it to about 120.
I think that is
ironically Moses lives to about 120.
Yeah. I think that is so important, Dustin. That the idea that like you look at this and go, why don't I get to live that long? And it's because it's dangerous for your faith. Yeah. That's why. What a great thought. So like the time is limited so that we have less time to forget God. Ha! What a beautiful insight, Pastor Beck. Thank you for that. I really appreciate that.
There's few and far between, but I get one in a couple.
Every so often out of Texas comes something good. Oh, I didn't say that on the radio. It's all the time out of Texas, right?
Yeah,
all the time. So the two other explanations I've heard for the length of life, just to throw them out there, I think yours is an interesting one. I've not really heard it before, is that they're just closer to the new DNA, so that the fresh human bodies aren't making lots of copies yet, so there's not a lot going wrong with the copies. So I can see that. The other one is related to the flood itself, and that something changed with the pressure system and the environment in such a way that it became less hospitable here, and that the flood caused a different type of and so you see after, Noah lives quite a while, but it drops off real quick after the flood. So what happened there?
How about the practical answer of just saying, they're populating the earth? It's kind of hard to populate the earth when you only live to be, 80 years old. This is the task of multiplying and filling the earth and subduing it. So maybe God's just saying, okay, this is what it's going to take, people that live for a millennium.
I wonder if there's also, I just realized how materialistic my answers were. Like maybe God just said it.
Yeah.
And now it changed, and that's the way it is, because that's what he does sometimes. It says things, and then they come into existence as he says them. All right, so we got a huge list of names here. I'm not going to read them all through, but the refrain remains. They live years, they father the crimson thread Messiah seed. They then live more years that are long, then they die. And this happens over and over again. We have Seth, we have Enosh, we have Kenan, we have Mahalalel, we have Jared. We have Enoch. We have a special thing happening with Enoch. Then we have Methuselah, and we have Lamech, and we have a special thing happening with Lamech. So, oh my goodness, we are going to run out of time. Let's talk about Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. That's weird.
Yeah.
And then we have this Lamech guy coming along, and he names Noah, saying, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from our painful toil of our hands. And then he dies, and then Noah lives and has Shem, Ham, and Japheth, which all happens before the flood's even in the picture. And I am going to jump ahead just a touch here and point out now, I don't remember this, but from your sheet that you sent me, actually I can put this on Facebook for people too here, I think, if I do this right. From your sheet that you sent me, it looks as if only Methuselah is alive when the flood comes. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, and everybody else. So Methuselah is the only one of these names who dies in the flood. Everyone else has already died. So that's a fascinating thing right there. You can't really see it very well on Facebook. So I want to talk about that, but maybe just give 30-second hat tip to Enoch. Poor guy. He's kind of important.
Yeah, Enoch, kind of a weird situation. Yeah, and I mean, the question that I can't seem to find an answer to is why. Like, why is Moses telling Israel about Enoch? I mean, and obviously, I mean, there's something special about him, noteworthy, but I just don't understand how this fits into the larger context, the larger story. And so that's something I'm still struggling with. But nevertheless, it just says God took him, right? He's there, and then he's not. This is, you know, I mean, it's reminiscent of Elijah being carried up in a whirlwind, right? Not tasting death kind of a deal. But I mean, it's not even as descriptive of that. At least in Elijah's case, we kind of, he tells him what's going to happen and then it happens, right? Here with Enoch, it's almost a footnote. It's just kind of, he walked with God, which kind of is a euphemism. He was close with God. He was devout. Enoch's name means dedicated or consecrated or trained up. And then, yeah, God just kind of takes him into heaven. So this is, I think this is pointed out on account of its uniqueness. He doesn't taste of death. There's a lot that you can do, a lot that you can perhaps think about or wrestle with as far as what this means. But it just kind of, it sticks out like a sore thumb with all the rest of these.
It does. It does.
Kind of their refrain of death here.
Let me give you my 1-2 cents on why it's here. So, And you can call me a liberal if you want, but I think that Moses didn't just write it all by himself right away. I think that there was an oral tradition of the word of God being passed on, and some of it had gotten down to the Israelites, and that this genealogy would have been one of those. And it's very, because it's so poetic, it's written to be remembered by memory, but to be written down. And so he's recording what he has received. And on Sinai, God's going to affirm it and, you know, strike out any lies that have been put in or whatever, however you want to see that. But that this is what Noah taught Shem, Ham, and Jeff to say, right? And it was a special thing that this guy, Enoch, walked with God and was taken to life. Right, taken to life. So that'd be my 2 cents. It's a tough one. I don't know. I want to talk about the we got very little time here again. Oh wait, I gotta throw you Noah. We got a good question from Facebook, and we shouldn't ignore it. So what's Noah's name about here? How do they know that he's going to bring relief from the work and painful toil, or does he actually bring relief? I'm not sure he does.
Well, I mean, he saves the people of God. He saves the faithful remnant.
True.
So I mean, in that way, he absolutely does. The Lutheran Study Bible's footnote, it says that Lamech names him, you know, comfort or relief because Lamech maybe believed that he was the promised seed,
right?
Which I found to be interesting, right? The one who would crush the head of the devil, right? And when you think about what's Noah's big deal. Noah's big deal is that he does, kind of in a Moses kind of way, deliver the people of God from the enemy, from death, right? But yeah, I mean, it's to say that the flood is good news is really, I mean, that's the flood is law, you know, the flood is the damning law of God that crushes down on, you know, the vast majority of the world. But here, yeah, Lamech has this again. And I think that this is the reason this is here is because this is propelling the story forward. This is Noah is the next guy that we're going to be talking about. We've talked about Cain. We've talked about Abel. We've mentioned that Seth is the one in line. Now it's time for the story, the account of Noah and how Noah brought the faithful people of God, his three sons, their wives, his wife, through the waters of the flood, that second cataclysmic event in history. And so, yeah, I think that's where it comes from, is that this is just propelling the story into the chapter 6 and following, out of the ground that Yahweh has cursed. This one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. So he's going to be faithful.
We've only got about 2 minutes left, and I'm going to have to use some of it to point out. So someone in the comments just has shared that According to the calculations that they've read about, Methuselah died 2 years before the flood. But I'm looking at the calculations that you sent me in this one thing, and it says he died a couple years after the flood. And this is the challenge with this. You go back to these numbers in the Bible, and it really isn't easy to come down on an actual agreed-upon consensus as to how this stuff lines up. And this is why we shouldn't be like, the earth is exactly this old to this day, because it depends on which numbers you're using when and how, and we have a history of this. I'm not getting this quite right. So I think that's just an important thing to say. You got 1 minute left to say whatever you want, Pastor Beck.
Well, Pastor Wolfmuller just chimed in about Methuselah, his death shall bring, which I think is one translation. Actually, the BDB also renders him the man of the dart, or the man who is spread out. And I commented in our notes together that I don't know if this is a chicken or egg situation. I did read that about the man of death, or rather his death shall bring. So the shalach they're bringing, and then muth or maweth, death. I think that there is some compelling evidence towards that. Essentially, though, this is the bridge chapter. This takes us from the story of the travesty of Cain and Abel. This takes us into what's next. This takes us into the account of the flood, the account of God saving His people through Noah. And so that's this is important for us to hear. This brings us right through the godly line of Seth. That we might be told of Christ later.
What is Pastor Wolfmuller doing listening to my show? Doesn't he have his own shows to be recording? Shouldn't he be producing something? That guy, he's being lazy.
You
he's on Facebook.
So productive.
Pastor Dustin Beck, you've helped me out a lot with this text this morning. Pastor Beck is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Corpus Christi, Texas, talking us through Genesis chapter 24, chapter 4 through the end of chapter 5, the lineage of Adam in Seth, the image of God continuing as a crimson thread, a line of Jesus' promise coming down to you. This is the story of the Old Testament. It is the Old Covenant promise that is fulfilled by Christ, who has, in a flood, been killed and raised for you, taking away death, sin, the power of the devil, and rising that you might live eternally. That day, my friends, is coming soon. You're listening to Sharper Iron on Worldwide KFUO. I am Jonathan Fisk, and I am looking forward to waking up with you at that dawn.